As armored cars and soldiers in riot gear entered city streets in 1969, the gerrymandered city of Derry, Londonderry, ceased to exist as a political entity. Its governing body, the Londonderry Corporation, was put in cold storage and replaced under Newtown legislation with appointed commissioners to a Londonderry Development Commission by order of Northern Ireland Prime Minister Terence O'Neill. British soldiers became a fixed presence across Northern Ireland, and men and women joined paramilitary organizations by the hundreds and the thousands. Through urban renewal, the rise of the surveillance attacks on the political landscape by the IRA, and a constant air of watchfulness, Derry was a changed place. Margot Shea, in her book, Derry City, Memory and Political Struggle in Northern Ireland. Welcome to Delmarva Today. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. On January 6, we witnessed an unprecedented, seditious siege of our nation's capital, resulting in the placement of a wire mesh fence and National Guard troops around the capital. The insurrection has also prompted an increasing recognition of right-wing paramilitary groups in the country. And a number of states are initiating voter suppression laws, including the redrawing of congressional maps. How do we make sense of the growing cultural conflict we witnessed on the 6th and still see playing out across the country? One way, historian Margot Shea argues, is to look at the conflict in Northern Ireland and see if there are parallels that can be drawn. My guest this morning is Margot Shea. Dr. Shea is a professor of history at Salem State University in Salem, Massachusetts. Margot, welcome to Delmarva Today.
I'm very happy to be here with you.
Well, I'm very pleased to have you here, Margot. We talked a while back about your book, Derry City, and I'm pleased that you're working on a new piece that you'd like to tell us about today. So, Margot, tell us about your article and the parallels you see between the troubles in Northern Ireland and our own cultural and political divisions today.
Okay, I would love to. I think as someone who grew up in the United States during the Troubles, I was kind of socialized and conditioned to feel not pity or sympathy, but a real deep concern for the people of Northern Ireland. And having lived there on and off for a long time, I think that maybe that changed a little bit. And over the last 5 years or so, I have really noticed the tides have turned. And it's my friends in Northern Ireland who are checking on me and expressing deep concern and deep anxiety about the level of violence in this country. I think that that began with the increased prevalence of mass shootings. And it was my friends in Northern Ireland, of all of the contacts I have around the globe, who would get in touch and who would express sympathy and concern and, you know, ask questions about my own sense of safety. And so for a while, I've sort of realized that this kind of idea that we have of the Troubles and civil violence as being someone else's issue has really come home to roost and is our issue. But on January 6th, 2021, I think that I felt that much more deeply, because the texts and the messages and the, you know, the Instagram kinds of direct messages were really flying in from Northern Ireland. And there, and then the news started to kind of make comparisons. Folks who've lived in Northern Ireland were writing posts, academics were writing posts. So I'm certainly not the only one who sees some parallels here and some kinds of historic congruences that we should pay attention to. But I will say that as someone who studied the roots of the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland, and as someone who paid close attention to the ways that that movement turned violent and ushered in a 30-year period of violence, I saw this connection between January 6th in the Capitol siege and something called the People's Democracy March of January 4th, 1969. And I think for any of us who were watching the events as they unfolded on TV and following on Twitter, there was this sort of shock that the home of our democracy could be occupied, and that the police and security details could then lead the occupiers very civilly, you know, by their arms, and kind of guide them off the grounds of the Capitol as if they had been there on a tour. And it reminded me so much of the People's Democracy March, at which civil rights demonstrators and protesters who were walking en route from Belfast to Derry were attacked by counter demonstrators. And it was the counter demonstrators who were protected by the local police force. And some members of the local police force actually participated in the attack on the civil rights demonstrators. And so for me, there was certainly an eerie sense, if not of deja vu, of, you know, I have seen this before, and this is worth paying attention to.
Was this the beginning of the violence, the attacks against the marchers?
January 4th, 1969 is often considered to be the beginning of violence. The next day, when demonstrators kind of straggled in black and blue into Derry City, now, that was the day that someone put "You are now entering Free Derry" on the gable wall. And so it's often considered to be kind of the iconic start. There was violence in October of 1968. So the violence did kind of begin earlier, but in terms of people really being conscious of the level of vitriol and the ways that physical force can kind of escalate, I think began with that People's Democracy March in January 69.
Remind us of what the march itself was all about before we get into more deeply into the parallel. What were people marching for? Were the major issues at that point?
There were three major issues, Hal, and they were housing. There was a major housing crisis that I'll talk to you about. There was kind of concerns about jobs, housing, jobs, and voting rights, right? So those were the three core principles of the civil rights movement. And it was mostly young people, college students at that point, who were involved in that really long march. It's not that far from Belfast to Derry, but it is over 60 miles. They were making a statement, right? And they were making a sacrifice, right, in terms of time and physical exertion.
So, well, tell us a little bit about the structural inequalities represented by these three main issues and others that you see, Marco.
I think it might be useful to define structural inequality. I tend to think of it as a system of privilege that's enacted by institutions within a society, within an economy. So the institutions can be things like law, law enforcement, business practices, government policies. The institutions might also include education, healthcare, the media. So I think that it's easy for all of us to understand that not only do these institutions sort of accompany us as we navigate through life, but they're really powerful in terms of the messages that they send about what we as individuals and as members of communities can sort of be reasonably expected to achieve in our life. So in Northern Ireland, the structural inequalities were really most striking in the areas of housing and policing. And in terms of the three platforms of the civil rights movement, they kind of get folded into these other issues. So I'd really like to talk about housing because I think that it might help listeners understand that issues that look like they're kind of about one thing actually turn out to be about lots and lots of things, right? So let me just talk a little bit about housing in Northern Ireland. You cannot underestimate how the amount of housing stock that was lost during the Second World War. People don't tend to think of Northern Ireland the way we think about London during the Blitz, right? With just blocks and blocks and blocks of demolished buildings. But the 50,000 units of housing were lost because of bombing attacks during the Second World War. And that was actually almost exactly the same amount of housing that was built between 1919 and 1939. So at the end of the Second World War, Northern Ireland had the same amount of housing that it had at the end of the First World War. And meanwhile, the population had grown quite a lot, and a lot of the housing that was left was in pretty poor condition. So housing construction became this enormous kind of segment of the economy and became something that the government took control over, right? Because it was so dire. So it's here that we begin to kind of have to unpack some of these issues around politics and sectarian differences in Northern Ireland, differences between Protestants and Catholics, who also align with political identities of unionism and nationalism. So, I mean, of course, Northern Ireland was constituted as a province and a part of the United Kingdom when the when Ireland proclaimed independence in 1921, based on this idea that the majority of its population had descended from English and Scots Protestant settlers who had arrived in the years after 1600 with the plantation of Ulster. So they were English, they were British, they were Protestant, that's how they identified, and they chose to remain part of the United Kingdom. But there was always a sizable minority, right? There was always, even at the creation of the border between Northern Ireland and the Free State, there were about 30% Catholic nationalists who really felt betrayed, right? They saw themselves as Irish. They identified with the rest of the island. A lot of them had participated in the fight for independence. And here they were, as kind of newly suspicious minorities who were seen as kind of quite likely liable to destroy the whole project of Northern Ireland if given too much power and too much clout. How does this relate to housing? It seems, I'll just explain that when they were coming up with these plans for housing, they were relating them to industrial expansion, and they were looking at areas of, you know, of most need. So in parts of Northern Ireland, particularly west of the River Bann, so places like Derry, but also places like Fermanagh and Tyrone, which had larger populations of Catholic nationalists, industry was not scheduled to be, and there wasn't investment planned for those areas. And because there wasn't investment planned for those areas, they were not targeted for real housing boom. So for areas where there were Catholic nationalists, the housing was not a priority. And even within those areas, there was this deep anxiety that if Catholic nationalists kind of got too much power, political power, that they might again kind of upset the whole cart. And so when housing was built in these areas with large Catholic nationalist communities, it was built around kind of very carefully and very often revisited political boundaries that were designed to return Unionist political representatives to local and provincial seats of power, of representative power, even when those Unionists were in the minority. Right. So all of a sudden you begin to see when there was housing being built, that housing was not being built in ways that were equal or equally accessible. So that was a huge complaint and one of the first kinds of pushes for the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland. The other thing was policing. And policing, you know, on one hand, it kind of makes a lot of sense given everything that I've just said. If you have a small, fragile, new political entity like the state of Northern Ireland, when you're going to create a police force to protect and serve, there was a sense of anxiety that nationalists might do everything in their power to kind of challenge the system and challenge the state and maybe even break it. And what also went along with that was some deep suspicion and some prejudice. And the result was that by the time the civil rights movement got underway in the 1960s, the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the police force in Northern Ireland, was 91% Protestant Unionist and only 9% Catholic and Nationalist. It was a very unrepresentative police force. And it wasn't only unrepresentative in terms of numbers, it was often unrepresentative in terms of how its officers interacted with members of the public. Again, that sounds super familiar to us.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and that does lead us into the next area I'd like for you to discuss, which is you say in your piece that the U.S. might be going the way of Northern Ireland in subtle and explicit ways. How might we be moving toward the problems of Northern Ireland?
You know, I think that one of the things that I started to really notice in the past year is one of the things that I would consider to be maybe more subtle. But in Northern Ireland, depending on whether you identify as Protestant and Unionist, or if you identified as Catholic and Nationalist, you would grow up with a totally different sense of history, right? You would have different historical dates that were important, different historical figures that were important. If you, you know, depending on which foot you kicked with, kind of to use the euphemism, you would have a totally different way of understanding someone like, say, Oliver Cromwell, right? Or Dan O'Connell. And one of the things that really struck me this year was the 1619 initiative, right? And the sort of push amongst American academics and public thinkers to really think about the argument that Ibrahim Kendi made sort of in Stamped from the Beginning about the ways in which we have to sort of think of the American historical experience beginning with slavery and being founded on a foundation of slavery. And all of a sudden to sort of look at 1619 as opposed to the arrival of the Mayflower, right? And sort of think about the roots and the foundations of this nation in sort of radically different ways, right? Is this a nation that's sort of like built in a fulcrum of capitalism and the enslavement of African people? Or is this a search for liberty and an escape from tyranny, right? Like, these are radically different. And we've seen, I think, over the past year, some real pushes on both sides of a political ideological divide to sort of cast our own awareness and understanding of our historical past. And it has become more explicit and more articulate than I have seen it in quite a while. And so that was one of the first things that I noticed, right? Was like, depending on where you are and, you know, where you're being educated and with what sort of ethos, You can grow up with a very, very different understanding from your textbook, right? From which holiday your state celebrates. So that's, I think, this codification of difference and this calcification of difference is tied up not just with a historic understanding, but this sense that depending on what news what news you listen to or tune into at night, or what podcast you listen to, where you buy your coffee, right? Sort of like which late night comedian you think is funny, or any, that's going to tell someone everything there is about you that they think they need to know. And that sort of division into camps, it sort of suggests that the center can't hold, right? And that the center, the things that the social institutions, the spaces where we would meet across differences, I think that certainly, you know, those have fallen up by the wayside because of COVID. And so we can't meet as our full selves in these spaces anymore. And I think that's exacerbated some of these differences. But I think these differences are real. And I think that they remind me of the ways that kind of Protestants and Catholics, Unionists and Nationalists sort of understood themselves in those years leading up to the Troubles, where there had been lots of mixing, and maybe it wasn't always equal or on equal ground, but there was space to engage. And as those spaces to engage fell away, there was only a way to engage among your own. So again, you know, we're a very different country and so many more divisions and diversities to the good and maybe to the problematic, but that is that, you know, that is kind of one thing that has struck me recently.
Margo, you mentioned three big parallels in your piece. One is the gerrymandering. The other is that this all of a sudden by young people, this creation of awareness and demand that we look at these foundational issues. And then the third is strikingly the militarization of the populace. Mention the three of those, if you would.
Absolutely. So gerrymandering is political redistricting to ensure political advantage in the face of political and demographic change. So in Northern Ireland, districts were gerrymandered or sort of moved, the boundaries were moved to make sure that often it was the case that political unionists would maintain advantages even in areas that were overwhelmingly Catholic and nationalist. And I really noticed that after the 2012 election cycle, the Republican National Committee, you know, laid out this, you know, autopsy of failure. And they said, like, we need to really change as a party if we're going to be a potent political force. And they talked about outreach, you know, outreach to women, African-Americans, Asians, and, you know, Hispanics, gay voters. And that didn't happen. And so instead, they have begun to redraw maps, right? And that there's this kind of sense that on a local level, and especially at the congressional level, in places like Florida, North Carolina, and Texas, that there's been a push to suppress voting and also to redraw voting maps. So I'm sure you've heard about this kind of law in the works to do away with mail-in voting, even though there was very little evidence of fraud in mail-in voting. Right. It opens up voting. It makes voting more possible for people. So that's kind of one thing that I thought was interesting. Youth activism, you know, I think is really important for us to be talking about, because certainly we all saw, you know, in our learning of history, the civil rights movement, and kind of our idea of it is that it was youth-led. I think that historians would argue that the civil rights movement of the 50s and 60s was not youth-led, although youth were involved. But today, I think what we see is that young people who have grown up kind of facing broken systems and trying to address them within their own communities really see at a ground level the need for change and the capacity for change. So this, the passion of, you know, I really think about the movement for Black Lives and leaders like Alicia Garcia and Patrice Cullors and Opal Tometi, you know, they have been sort of looking at individual issues and then kind of opening up to a sense of needing to really rethink a lot of our systems. And that's what I think that there's a real difference between some other protest movements of the past, in that there is this, there's a commitment and a drive to really look at how we might change our institutions in order to deliver more equity and to make the promises that have sort of been spoken about in American history real for more people. And then the final thing is like this issue of paramilitarization and self-defense. I don't think that we use the language of paramilitaries to talk about individuals and citizens who arm themselves and present themselves as kind of a policing force in certain pockets and certain communities of this country. But certainly the Ku Klux Klan can be understood by the definitions of paramilitarization as a paramilitary organization. And so I think the January 6th is a really good example. And I think, you know, the other thing that I think is interesting is the number of Black people in this country who feel sufficiently unsafe that they are arming themselves and taking advantage of their Second Amendment right in numbers that we haven't seen before. So as the citizenry arms and as paramilitary organizations proliferate, and as we have an unrepresentative police force that there's lots and lots of evidence that it doesn't police, right, you know, representatively and fairly, we seem to have a little bit of a powder keg going on here, Hal.
Well, what do we do?
You know, I think that a year or two ago, I might have like offered up some niceties about listening into the difficult spaces and, you know, being committed to maintaining civility across divides. And where I sit now, I think I'm falling much more on our need as ordinary citizens to push and to push hard with our representatives to really think about the structural conditions that undergird inequality in this country and how we can change them. I can say that in Northern Ireland, you know, the changes to the police force itself made an enormous difference in bringing about a lasting peace, right? They changed its name. They made it accountable to outside bodies who had access to everything, to independent policing boards. They demilitarized, right? Like, we have militarized our police so much since 9/11, and that cannot be a useful thing. So maybe thinking about the use of military equipment in civilian policing is something we can really think about. Interestingly enough, the plastic, quote unquote, bullets that were used in protests to kind of curb protesters across this country were really famously used in Belfast and Derry. Maybe we need to think about how we as a country and how our police forces deal with peaceful protest, right? These are just some things. Changing, you know, changing culture is hard. And changing culture takes time, but I think that we can look at our institutions and we can invite people who have been left out of the conversation, of the privilege, and we can invite them in much more fully than we have before to start to offer direction on how to open up our institutions and redress the systemic inequality that plagues us. And I think that's where the promise lies.
Margot, what a timely and fascinating discussion. you've brought to us and to our radio audience today. I want to thank you for joining me on Delmarva today. And I want to thank all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.